You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. Every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, this show brings you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and international parental abduction. We will introduce you to specialized schools and treatment programs that can really help and new innovations in these areas. With over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals in these fields. I will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today one such talented and caring person, Dean Bales. Dean is a drug and alcohol counselor in Orange County, California. But that's not the whole story by a long shot. Dean was a drug dealer back in the 90s and used to, and after being shot 9 times and left for dead, he has turned his life around and now helps teens and others in jail turn their lives around. He has written a book called I Didn't Know What Clean and Sober Was to chronicle his life, and he sends it to our local prisons to help the inmates to reconsider where they are headed and what they can do to change it. Dean, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I got to tell you, when I first read a little bit about you, I realized that the one thing that was the most amazing part, tell us about being shot 9 times and living through it.
Well, I'm glad to be here, that's for sure. Not too many people live through 9 bullets.
Mm-hmm.
People die after one.
That's right. I mean, I would guess that your feeling is that's a miracle in itself.
Oh, I thank God every day for it.
Absolutely. Well, tell us a little bit about the story, taking us from where you started and what happened to get you to where you are today.
Well, I started using drugs around 13 years old, and it was pot at first and alcohol and then everything else. Back in the 70s, there was just every kind of drug you could think of out there, and in no time at all, we were using drugs before we went to school, and next thing you know, we weren't going to school at all, and never graduated from school, and just continued on. And so that was 30 years of using drugs my whole entire life. You know, I was able to keep a job, worked for McDonnell Douglas for 13 years, but I used the whole time. And so that just, I ended up, I lost that job at McDonnell Douglas and ended up selling drugs for a living, and then led from started doing cocaine and selling cocaine and crack cocaine and using a needle and slamming cocaine, and then methamphetamine came around.
Wow.
And that's the hard one right there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, did you get arrested? Did you end up going in and out of jail in regards to this, or were you one of those that seemed to slip through?
No, I ended up getting busted twice for felony sales with loaded weapons, and I was looking at 18 years in prison.
Wow. What kept you from having to do that much?
I accepted God into my life while I was in jail, and basically I bailed out of jail and turned my life around and went to Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, and joined the prison ministry and the drug and alcohol ministry and the New Believers ministries, and just basically turned my life around while I was still waiting on court. And the judge, 6 months later, the judge saw what I was doing with my life and how I turned my life around, and she gave me leniency and suspended my sentence of 18 years in prison and gave me time served and 3 years probation.
Wow. That's a miracle right there. Now, let's kind of start in the beginning. You said at age 13, and I'm guessing we're probably pretty close to the same age. what was the situation at that point in time in regards to your family life? What was going on in your family, and did that contribute to the situation?
My parents were both alcoholics, and you know, I grew up with that my entire life, you know, with the fights every night and the not caring where we were or what time we came home or what we did. And basically, you know, I had a really loving, you know, parents, but they were alcoholics and they really didn't care, you know, what time we came in or what we did.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like, what was the rule? Everything's okay as long as you don't touch ours?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that still happens to this day, and we've run into some cases where we've transported young people to specialized programs, and it's interesting, there are times in which when we go to pick them up, we have a report from the parents, and we have it from the parents, from the psychologist, psychiatrist, or whatever professional is working with them, saying that this is what the child is going through. And then when we pick the child up, there are times in which the child says to us, well, you don't understand. You're taking the wrong person. The real reason why, you know, why today they decided that I needed to go to a program wasn't because I was using, because I've been using for the last 2 years. They said now was because I took theirs.
You know, a little story on that same situation is I have a son too, and he started following just, you know, the apples don't fall too far from the tree, and he started using drugs also at an early age. And I was over at the juvenile court for him. This is after I got clean, but he was using. And, the courtrooms there, they don't bring everybody in. The parents have to wait on the outside, out in the hallways and all that. And it's funny, you know, all the times that I went over there to that courthouse, I recognized everybody in the hallway, everyone that was there, all the parents I knew, because I'd done drugs with them, you know, in my earlier days. So, and it was no surprise that their kids were here at the courthouse, just like mine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something for our listeners to think about. I know that we get questions, and I had a question that came on one of the other shows, but this might be a good one for you, and that is, what should the parent tell the child, the parent who did use, what should they tell the child that asked them, what did you do when you were my age?
I don't like that old saying, do what I do, not as I say. Mm-hmm. Do as I say, not as I do. The bottom line is you just got to, you got to take control of your child this day, today, you know, in this day and age. You got to, it doesn't matter what you did or, you just got to, you know, you got to take a hold of him because he's going to get lost real quick.
Mm-hmm. But again, as far as what you tell them, I know that again, we had the question that came in, and the way that I answered it, and I guess I'll ask you, I mean, would you agree with this? And it was a young woman, probably in her early 20s, that said that, you know, she, you know, is, I think, engaged to get married, I think she was, and she is really looking forward to having kids. But she said, what should she tell them when they get to the point and say, well, did you use drugs, or did you like drugs, or what was your involvement? My answer to her was, I don't think that you should lie, but you also don't need to volunteer a lot. And what I said was, you know, from what she was saying now, she still does, and she likes it. And I said, you don't need to share that part of it. I would imagine that at some point in time, you have used drugs, and there are bad experiences that you've had from it. Share those. You don't need to share the part, you know, well, you know, I really liked it when I did it at this time. I think if you share the part and you say, yes, I did, and let me tell you the things that it did to my life that were not good. I mean, would you agree with that answer?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you can't turn around and tell the kid all the good times that you had doing drugs, and there was good times. But there's a whole lot more bad times than there ever was good times. And
exactly.
I don't know anyone in this world that can not agree with that. So definitely share all the bad things that ever happened to you while were using.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. And what would you say to the people out there that the professionals out there that are working with addicts, how can they help their clients find sobriety? What would you say to those people?
What do you mean by...
Well, in other words, I mean, as far as the listeners out there, if there are listeners out there that are struggling with addiction themselves, either with alcohol or with drugs, I mean, what would you say to them? And then also, what would you say to some of the professionals out there that are having addicts come to them and say, hey, this is what I'm dealing with? You know, in other words, what would you tell them?
Well, the number one thing they got to do is get into a detox and get the drugs out of their system. And I mean, that's the number one thing, is try to get at least a week or 10 days clean with a detox. And then you got to get into some kind of program. You can't do it alone. You need help. And, you know, my particular case is I accepted God into my life, and that's the number one with me. As a drug and alcohol counselor, I believe that everybody has to have God in their life. Mm-hmm. I need his power to get off of the drugs. I can't do it alone. And I use his power.
That's great. Now, for the professionals out there, what can they do when they have somebody that comes in that's not willing at this point in time to detox?
Well, in some cases, you just got to let nature take its course and let the law step in. And sooner or later, they're going to hit some kind of temporary bottom. And they're going to end up in jail and everything else. But, you know, for somebody that's unwilling, I mean, the first part of recovery is a willing or a desire to quit. Mm-hmm. You pretty much got to have it. You can't get recovery without a desire.
Yep. And in fact, let's do that. Let's talk about hitting bottom. Do you feel someone has to hit bottom to begin a successful recovery?
Absolutely. Hitting bottom is something that that we all have to do at some particular case. But what is hitting bottom? Is it the circumstances that you've been through? And I was shot 9 times. Was that my bottom? No, that wasn't my bottom. I got busted for felony sales with loaded weapons, with a shotgun in my car and a pound of meth. Was that hitting bottom? No, that wasn't hitting bottom, because I continued to use. I got busted again for felony sales and was in jail looking at 18 years in prison. Is that hitting bottom? No, that's just one circumstance after another. And you will hit one circumstance after another, after another, after another, until you'll hit bottom after bottom after bottom after bottom until you quit. So what is hitting bottom? You know, bottom is the day when you look up and you say, God, please help me. I can't take this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. Well, you just hit bottom right then. That's when you turn around and you look up and you ask God for help. And you've just hit bottom, because now you're coming up. You're asking.
You're asking for help. Now, let's expand a little bit on how God is mentioned in 5 of the 12 steps of AA.
Well, you know, it's no surprise. You know, a lot of people call AA religion and everything else. It's just a spiritual program. You know, it's very spiritual. God is mentioned in 5 of the 12 steps, and for a reason. You know, you may not. I personally didn't like work the 12 steps, but, you know, I went to church and been going to church and still go to church, and those steps get worked while I'm at church and Bible studies. It's the same deal.
Well, let's walk through them. Let's walk through some of the steps that people are going to go through, the ones that you went through. In other words, if there's 5 of the different steps, which ones continually brought you up?
Well, the number one is accepting God into my life. I mean, that's right. You know, that's just the number one step for me. You know,
right.
is believing that there is a God and wanting something better in my life. You know, I never really cared what happened to me. You know, it's just like I just didn't care. And then once I had God in my life, I wanted to live. I finally wanted to live.
Well, I'm very, very glad that you wanted to live and that you did get God in your life. Now, you know, as a drug and alcohol counselor in Orange County, what is the percentages in regards to minors versus adults that you have in your classes? Is this something to where they're getting younger as far as the kids that you're working with?
Well, right off the bat, you got to be driving a car. So you're going to be 16 at least. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at 16, pretty much the kids are just learning how to drive, much less drink and drive. So generally speaking, the DUIs start in around 19, 20, 21 years old. And there's a whole lot of them at 21, 22, 23 years old. A lot of DUIs out there.
What are some of the things that you can, what are some of the things that you're doing to help them through that?
Well, we teach all the, you know, recovery topics on recovery and try to get them sober. I mean, that's the number one thing. You know, it's hard to get a DUI if you don't drink.
Right.
So, I mean, that's what we work on, trying to get a live a clean and sober life.
Okay. What's the age of the youngest person that you've had to counsel?
Oh, boy, I've counseled some 13, 14, 15-year-old, you know, boys and girls.
Okay, now, when you're counseling them, are they in juvenile hall, or, in other words, are you going in to see them, or are they out at that point in time?
They're out at that point. You know, I have been in the juvenile halls and prisons and jails. I have a ministry that sends books into the juvenile halls and jails and prisons all over the United States.
Well, and tell us a little bit about the book.
I wrote the book. It's a story of my life, and it's basically everything that ever happened to me while under the influence of drugs and using drugs. And it's a long story because a lot of things have happened to me, and it's basically how I turned my life around and how I live a clean and sober life now.
Now, I mean, but does it also chronicle the bad times?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what probably 90% of the book is.
Well, take us through a little bit of that, because one of the things that I'd like the listeners to understand, if there are people out there that are going through some of the same type of things, I want them to realize, first of all, they're not alone, and secondly, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that no matter how bad they think their situation is, that there are people out there that have gone through that or worse, and have now turned their life around and are not only doing good for their own life, but for other people's lives as well.
Well, you know, to begin with, when I was using drugs, I thought that was the life. You know, this is the life. This is the way I wanted to always be. I couldn't see anything else. I didn't know anything else. I started using at such an early age, I didn't know what clean and sober was, and that's the title of the book. I didn't know what clean and sober was. I never gave it a chance. I had no idea. And today I have an idea. You know, it's like, wow, I never could have known that life could be this beautiful today. You know, it's just, it's an awesome world without having to wake up every day craving and dying for some kind of drug, living in bondage to some kind of drug, waking up in the morning and the first thing that goes through your head is, how am I going to get high today? How am I going to get high today? You know, it's so nice to wake up today and not need anything to get high. You know, I just wake up, I'm smiling early in the morning. I don't sleep all day anymore like I used to when I was using. I wake up and it's a beautiful day out no matter what, whether it's raining or sunny or whatever, because I'm sober and I'm clean. And it's like, it's just a beautiful world today. And I never knew it could be this good. I had no idea.
Well, for some of our younger listeners, explain to them what the difference was in the 70s versus now. Why it seems so much more acceptable?
Well, I don't know about, I don't know. It was more acceptable back then.
Right.
You know,
that's what I mean.
Yeah. In the 70s, you know, you could do anything and get away with anything. And basically, I remember so many times getting pulled over by the cops with alcohol in the car and drugs in the car, and they'd just take them out and pour them in the street and pour the beer on top of them and send you on your way, you know? Or maybe if you were drunk driving back then and you were underage, they just took the keys away from you and told you to walk home. You can't do that today. You're not going to get away with that today.
Mm-hmm.
The law is out there to get you, and it's going to incarcerate you. Our jail, they're just building jail after jail after jail after jail, and they're all full. You can't get away with that anymore, especially with the DUIs. We've got DUI task forces, you know, that are specifically out there to stop you from drinking and driving. And that's going to stay with you for 10 years right off the bat. Mm-hmm. It's going to be on your record for life, but it's going to be used against you for 10 years. And and another thing that they don't tell a lot of people right now is if you do get a DUI, you will not be able to drive with any measurable amount of alcohol in your system for 3 years, or it will be another DUI. And that means a .001.
So anything at all.
Anything at all.
A .001, is that like...
That's NyQuil.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's exactly what I was thinking, was NyQuil.
That's a DUI.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd be looking at 45 days in jail, a 2-year suspension of your license, and an 18-month DUI course.
Well, and the most important part of it, I think, is that what if you hurt somebody?
Absolutely.
I mean, for the rest of your life, you are going to live with the fact that you have either hurt somebody or taken somebody's life.
Well, that's the number one, and this just happens all the time. It just happened again just a week and a half ago. A girl was killed. So this is but now it's murder.
Yeah.
See, we've signed a thing when we renew our license now, and you're going up for murder charges if you hit somebody and kill them now. They're not going lightly on you. You're going to be put away for life.
Right, because that, you know, if you're impaired, that's potentially a weapon you're driving.
It's a loaded weapon. You know, the keys are the bullets and the car is the gun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you mentioned the book. The book is called I Don't Know What Clean and Sober Was. And I just want to share with everybody that for every book that's sold, Dean sends one into the prison system for young people to read. Dean, where can they? How can they get, if they want to order the book, how can they get it? How can they order it?
I have a website. It's alcoholdrugsaddiction.com, and they can go to that website and order it on there, and it's completely nonprofit. There's no money involved in this at all. Whatever they pay for the book is just for mailing and shipping fees and the process of the book to get sent in where these kids can read it. You know, and why are they sitting in jail? They need to be reading something other than a Maxim magazine. You know, they need something that's going to help them, and that's what my book is there for.
And I think that's great. Now, if anyone has additional questions for you, do they go to you through the website, or is there a phone number they can call, or?
alcoholdrugsaddiction.com. There's they can ask all the questions they want on there, and I'll give them all the help that I can possibly give them.
Wow, it's very, very much appreciated. We're going to take a break. We will be right back with Dean Bales.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
We're back with Dean Bales, and we are talking about addiction. And Dean, what was the bottom for you that allowed you to turn things around?
Well, I was in jail on Christmas Eve, 1998, I went to a prison service just to get out of the cell. It was Christmas Eve, and I wanted to just get out of the cell because it was, you know, Christmas. And I went in there to the prison ministry, and I sat down, and the first thing the pastor said was, "Is this the best you can do with your life?" And I looked around, and everybody in their jumpsuits and tattoos, and there was, you know, drug addicts and thieves and alcoholics and just every walk of life in there. And I thought about it, and I said, "Is this the best I can do with my life?" And I thought, well, yeah, this is the best I can do. Well, if this is the best I can do, I'm not doing a very good job with my life. I'm looking in here in jail and looking at 18 years in prison. Hey, I don't do a very good job of controlling my life. So next thing, he turned around and he said, well, God has a beautiful life plan for each and every one of you in this room right now. All you got to do is just let him into your heart. And I thought about that, and I was weighing it out. 18 years in prison, beautiful life. 18 years in prison, beautiful life. And right at that second, I chose the beautiful life. And I accepted God into my life right then, and I started bawling and crying in front of everybody, and it was one of the greatest feelings that I've ever had in my life. Better than drugs, better than anything. And from that day on, I never used again. But that was the turning point that night. I went back to the cell and I scrounged up a Bible and I started reading it, and didn't make much sense to me, this and thou and all the words, but somebody told me, well, you'll understand it when the time comes. And it's been like that for 10 years now. I've been clean, and that was basically the turning point.
Well, now what about for those that say that, I mean, drugs are a physical addiction. But yet what you're saying is that at the moment in which you made that change, the physical addiction wasn't there. Let's break that down.
Well, I had already been in jail at that point. I got busted on Thanksgiving Eve. So that was the 26th of November, and this was the 24th of December. So I had already been clean 30 days at that point. So basically, you're over the detox limit 30 days later. Most drugs are mental. Cocaine is a mental addiction. Marijuana is mental. I mean, even methamphetamine has a lot, just mainly mental. So that's the one you really got to work on, is changing the head, changing the inside. It's an inside job, not an outside occurrence.
Okay, well, let's break down addiction. What are some of the things, that you see that's going on out there with addiction, and what can be done to change it?
Well, methamphetamine is a big one right now, and I see so many kids that are going off the wrong direction on meth, and I did it for about 12 years, and so I know all too well how hard it is to get off of. I know a lot of friends that are still on it, some that are still fighting to get off of it, and with meth, it's poison. It's just pure poison. Everything that goes into making meth will kill you if you ingest it alone, on its own. And but yet when we mix it together and we eat it and we snort it and we drink it and we shoot it and you ingest it all different kinds of way, and it's pure poison. And the very first thing you have to do to get off of meth is detox your system. Just get it completely out of your system. And and once you do that, you stand a fighting chance, because you feel a whole lot better. And then you can start in with your recovery topics and get into some kind of program. And then you definitely need to get into a sober living, some place where there's other people that are going through the same thing as you, that you can support each other. And you can't just go back to your old turf, and you're just not going to make it there,
What are the percentages now of people that are getting out? In other words, at times I hear different percentages from different people. Do you know?
Yeah. I'm afraid to even say that one, because the percentages are not good, and they're not good at all. It all depends on what kind of program somebody goes through, but it's like 4 to 8%, and that's really bad. And we're talking about staying off of drugs for a lifetime.
Okay. And we're talking primarily about adults now, aren't we? Because I think most of the statistics that I've read that are along those lines are dealing with adults. Because I've also read that the statistics with adolescents is much higher.
Yeah. Before they, kids don't end up in rehab all too soon. So it's basically into their adult age before they get into a rehab. But yeah.
But would you say that? If we catch them early, we have a much, much better chance of them, not going through it, or of kicking it and staying off of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you can, just the very first signs of your kid using any kind of drug at all, I mean, let's start with the marijuana. You know, I remember when I first started on marijuana, I didn't think it was a, you know, led to other stronger drugs and all that. It absolutely does. Once you start getting high on that, you might as well try this and try that and try this, and it just leads to more and more drugs. So, I mean, this, you know, this new legalized marijuana thing is crazy. You know, all these kids are running around that I see with marijuana cards in their pockets. It's out of this world. I don't even understand it.
Well, and I think another point that people out there need to know, marijuana today versus marijuana in the 70s is completely different. I mean, just the strength of it is just incredible. So I I've heard parents that are, you know, maybe closer to my age that have said, well, you know, but I smoked some marijuana back in the late 70s and, you know, it's not that bad. And go, you're now talking about something that's about 10 times as powerful. You know, so I don't think they realize that, because you have this 40-something or 50-something parent that hasn't, they haven't done it in 20 years. So they don't realize it really has changed.
Yeah, they got the hybrid out there now and the chronic, and you say 10 times, I say more like 25 or 30 times stronger.
Okay, you probably know better.
The old $10 commercial in the old days, you could sit down and smoke a half ounce of it, and today you can barely smoke a half a joint of this chronic, and you're totally wasted, and you absolutely can't drive on that. And that brings me to another thing is we're getting a lot of DUIs out there now that from kids smoking weed, as well as taking, you know, pills and everything else. They're coming in. It's not just alcohol. It's these other drugs as well. I've got probably 10 kids right now with DUIs from smoking weed. Mm-hmm. And it's in their system for 30 days. So if that cop pulls them over and he rolls down that window and smells any kind of weed in there at all, he knows you've had a joint within the last couple of days, and you're going in on a DUI because you're going to test positive for up to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, and that's a good point that you brought up when you said up to 3 weeks, because what a lot of people don't realize, they think that certain things come out of their system very quickly. Marijuana is not one of them. And as you said, it can be, depending on how fast somebody's metabolism is, it can be as short as maybe 21 days, but it could be as long as 28 days that it's in their system. So the person that thinks, well, you know, I'm fine now to go drive because I'm, you know, I didn't smoke but 3 days ago, guess what? You may not do anything wrong. You might may be in an accident that isn't your fault, but it's going to be in your system.
Yeah, and it's you know, with the chronic and the high THC levels that are in it, and these and the hybrid weed now, for somebody that is a regular smoker, you know, they've built up a really high tolerance to it, and they smoke a lot of it, even the good stuff, because they just don't get high on it anymore. It can be in their system for 45, 50 days, maybe a couple months, because it's just high levels of THC that they've been smoking.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did get some listener questions, and I have a couple that I want to ask you, and one I think fits quite well. And this comes in from a listener who says, I'm suspicious that my son might be a drug dealer on the side. I notice the type of element he's interacting with and the late-night calls he receives. When I asked him about his using drugs about a year ago, he ran away. What advice can you give me? Should I turn him into the authorities? How do I talk to him about this?
Well, to begin with, if you suspect that he's been using drugs, then he is. He obviously is, no doubt. You know, late night calls and just, you know when your kid is just no longer your kid anymore. He just shows all these different signs, and he's just a different person. So, you know, right off the bat, if you suspect it, no doubt he probably is. But as far as, you know, turning them into the law, absolutely. You know, a little story on that. When my son was using, I wouldn't let him stay at the house. You know, I've been through Al-Anon, and, you know, they said, hey, absolutely. You know, he cannot stay at that house if he's using drugs. And so he would, you know, as soon as he'd start using, he'd take off, just like this lady's kid did. And anyway, so he'd be living at the park and different, you know, friends' house and all that, and I'd be worrying about him and losing sleep over it and everything else, and I'd just be hoping that the police picked him up. I hope the cops get him. I hope the cops get him, you know, and that way he'll be safe in jail where I won't have to worry. And then, you know, within 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, yeah, I'd get the phone call that I was expecting, and, hey, Dad, guess where I'm at? And I'd go, I don't know, where you at? No, I'm in jail. And, you know, and the first thing I do, my parenting kicks in, or non-parenting kicks in, my love for my child, and I'd say, okay, well, let me get a lawyer, let me see if I can get you out. And then I put up the money and I bail him out of jail, you know? It's crazy, you know. It's like, you know, sometimes our love just gets in the way of what we really should be doing. We need to just let him stay in jail, let him suffer the consequences. And the more consequences they suffer right now at an early age, the better their chances of not wanting to go back there again. So definitely when the kid is like, you know, 13, 14 years old or whatever young age, and he gets in trouble, let him stay in there. Do not even visit him. You know, the more he suffers in there, you know, my big mistake is even when they did go to jail, I'd put all this money on their books and I'd be there visiting and all that. I was making it as comfortable for them as I could, and that was a mistake. I finally learned that now. I don't put money on my son's books anymore, and I don't make it easy for him in there, and he doesn't want to go back there.
That's good. Now, at what point do you help, but only from the standpoint of advising the court that you know, that you want to get them into a good program, you know, and that you'll help fund that?
What do you mean exactly?
Well, what I mean is that, you know, we know that, I mean, once they get arrested, oftentimes you can go in with an attorney and say, look, can we suspend the sentence if he goes to XYZ program to detox and then to learn how to function without drugs?
Oh, well, that's the key.
Right.
That's the key right there, is just getting the jail time held over their head.
Right.
That's the number one thing, is get them some kind of sentence and have the jail time held over their head, because that's what's going to keep them in the rehab. That's what's going to keep them from running from the rehab. That's what's going to keep them from using while they're in rehab or sober living, is having that jail time over their head.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, one of the things that I found, too, is that with where the parents can't afford it, if they go in with an attorney and they have a program picked out that's either been picked by their ed consultant or psychiatrist, psychologist, some form of counselor, if they have a program that's picked out, it becomes a win-win situation. First of all, it is going to be a good program that's been chosen for them. The other win-win is that, yes, the judge will hold it over their head, but also the judges tend to want to go for it because of the fact that it doesn't cost money. It doesn't cost their, you know, their court money. It doesn't cost their county money. If the parents are going to fund it, I have seen many, many times in which the judge says, absolutely, and then puts it in his order that says they're going to go out to this program, and if you don't complete it, you're coming back in and you're going to get the full wrath of my court. And I think in those situations, I think there's been some excellent success, because, as you say, if you leave it over their head, much better chance that they're going to finish that program and do it right.
Yeah, it doesn't do any good to you know, put kids in jail, you know, for drug use and all that, because when they get out, that's the first thing they do. They run right back to it. So any time that you can pick out a recovery home and do that in lieu of jail is absolutely the way to go, because, you know, jail just doesn't work for keeping, you know, turning drug addiction away, you know, because the whole time they're in there just sitting there doing their time, they're thinking about the day they get out and how they're going to go use, you know.
Okay. What's your impression of the statement that we've all heard at one point or another that says that jail just teaches them to be a better criminal?
I agree with that. Institutionalized. When they, you know, you try to keep your kids away from, you know, gang members and gangs and all that stuff, and here they turn around and they throw them in jail with, you know, thousands of them, you know, and they make all kind of connections and all kind of friends and everything else, and they get out and they have all these new people that they've met in jail.
Yeah, new contacts.
New contacts, new gang members, new all that, you know, and now that's definitely, you know, it can get institutionalized.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another listener question that says, I'm amazed at how you survived your horrendous close-to-death experience. At the time, how did you deal with the aftermath, and did you go through extensive therapy?
Well, I'll tell you, the aftermath, I was in a coma for 13 days, and when I came out of a coma, I started selling drugs out of the intensive care unit. And the nurses were letting people in two at a time, and my dealer came there and dropped off a large quantity of dope, and I was dealing right on the intensive care unit. So it didn't slow me down a bit. I had a colostomy bag, you know, and I was just wounded all over from head to toe with 9 bullets in me, and I was still dealing. I didn't slow down at that point.
Well, give us the details of the shooting. I mean, this is 9 shots that came in all in one attack?
All in one attack, yeah.
And was this over the drugs?
I was dealing drugs, and it was about 1:50 in the morning, and I was outside in the driveway working on this refrigerator, and these guys came up out of the blue, and they stuck 9 millimeters in our face, me and a friend of mine, and he said, "Where's it at? Where's it at?" I said, "Where's what at? You know where it's at. Where's the shit at?" And I said, "In the garage." And he made me walk into the garage with the gun on the side of my head with a laser on the side of it. And he said, "Where's it at?" And I pointed towards this cabinet. And he said, "Get out on the ground. Get out on the ground." And I laid face down on the ground, and he had his foot on my back. About that time, his buddy pulled the gun away by accident from my other buddy out in the driveway, and he grabbed the gun, and they started fighting over it. Then the guy that had his gun on me was yelling at him, "Shoot him, shoot him, shoot him." And then he turned around to me, and I was laying face down on the ground, and he just started shooting me in the back. And he shot me 5 times in the back, and then I rolled over. And then he turned around, and he shot my buddy in the shoulder. And then by that time, I was trying to get away on my hands and knees through the garage. And next thing I know, he turned around and shot me 4 more times.
Wow. I think, as I said when we started, it's a miracle that you're still here.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I thank God.
Well, in your opinion, would you say that the drug problem is now better or worse today than it was at that time?
Well, you know, it was bad back then, and there was a lot of drugs back then, but we got away with it back then. And you just don't get away with it now. You get busted now. You get incarcerated now. And so for that reason, it's way worse now, because you end up in jail. You end up in prison. And that's just no place to be.
Okay, but it's worse. But in essence, does that mean it's better? In other words, you know, is it more rampant? In other words, is that working? Being put in jail, you know, being stricter on it, coming down on it more, is it working? Are we taking more of the drugs out of the system and away from our kids? Or do we still have the same problem, or is it getting worse?
No, it's getting worse, I think, if anything. We're just getting more and more kids that are just, you know, at a younger age still, you know. And we got some, like I said, this methamphetamine thing is at epidemic stages right now. And you got young kids that are using it now and selling it. And it's so easy to make, and it's so easy to buy, and it's not very expensive. And it's just an epidemic out there right now.
What would you suggest that we do as a society?
Well, we can keep doing what we're doing, and there is some you know, some tough laws out there right now, but we need more money for our kids, and there's a lot less thing for kids to do today than there was then. You know, back when we were kids, there was always a field to go ride your mini bike in or your motorcycle in, and now it's just like there's a lot less things for kids to do. They're sitting behind a computer in their house somewhere, and you know, and doing meth and playing on the computer and everything else. We need some more things for the kids to do out there.
Well, and I think what I hear you saying, there needs to be more things that the kids are doing with their family. I think there's too many things they're doing either on their own or at least unsupervised.
Absolutely. Yeah, it all starts with the family. It all starts with You know, I get some clients and they come in and they say, hey, I got a 2-year-old kid or I got a 3-year-old kid. And the first thing I do is tell them, hey, you can make your life a lot easier right now if you just spend some time with your boy and just and be there for him and be there for his little league games and his basketball games and just be there to support him. And it'll make your life a whole lot better down the road when he's 15, 16. Mm-hmm. You won't be visiting him over at the juvenile hall and over at the jail and paying for lawyers and everything else. It starts with you right now becoming a parent. Becoming a good parent and being there for your kid and talking to your kid and spending time with them, you know, down mm-hmm. the road. It's just, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, if I could have, and I'm, for those that can't, obviously you can't see this, if I could have President Obama seated in one of these chairs between us, what would you ask them to do, at least from a funding standpoint? What would you ask the powers to be to do in our country to help this problem and to help get us in a direction to where things are getting better?
Well, personally, you know, we started to get a little Prop 36 money and some money, and we're working actually towards getting some programs going in the prisons and jails now, and that's great. Because these people are a captive audience, you know, they're sitting there in their cells. What better time to teach them and send them through a rehab while they're in jail? Turn the jails into a rehab. Turn them into programs. Why not? It wouldn't cost that much money, you know, to actually get them the rehabilitation that they need while they're at the prison.
Okay, all right. But also, I'm thinking, let's put our families in a position to where they are not so incredibly stressed to make ends meet that they can spend more time. I mean, when we go back, I mean, what, you know, the percentages of two-parent families working in the 70s, I'm sure was much, much lower than it is today. You know, so where there are more things to where the families are doing more things with their kids, I think if we can start spending the money there, spend it there, and hopefully we don't have to spend as much after they're in jail.
Yeah, that's a good point right there. Yep, I agree with that.
So, well, what advice would you give today's teens regarding the rampant abuse of drugs and alcohol and where it might lead them?
Well, I know where it'll lead them. It that hasn't changed. Jail, institutions, and death. And, you know, it happens all the time. And as a somebody that used for 30 years, if I told you all, told you about all of the friends that I've lost that have died from the use of drugs right now, it would probably blow your mind because it's that many of them. Jail, institutions, and death, that's where it leads you every single time. There is no other place. There is no success story. There is no, you know, pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You know, you're going to die, you're going to be incarcerated, or you're going to be in some kind of program. Or mentally, you might never recover from it.
Right. And so I think that what you're saying is that you're the exception, okay? You got out. You're the exception. And what you're saying is it wasn't pretty.
No.
So even as the exception of someone who got out, it still was not a pretty experience. It still was not a good experience. And that's as good as they can look forward to.
Yeah, it's you know, I am the exception, and there's a lot of people like me. I do have a lot of friends now that have turned their life around, and most of them have done it through God and or with the help of God and programs. And you know, I am, you know, one of the small percentage that you know, that have gone this far. You know, I went back to college and got a degree in drug and alcohol counseling, and I've been working in the field for 8 years now, and I love what I do. I love helping people. I love my ministry that sends these books into prisons and jails, and this is something that God wanted me to do. You know, that's was an awesome program there.
All right. Well, believe it or not, time has flown by. We've only got just a couple of minutes. What's the one message you would like to leave everybody before we end this?
Well, just what I was just saying, that you know, the one message out there is there's no good results from using drugs and alcohol. There's nothing that good comes from it. Like I say, 10 years of being clean now, it's like there's nothing like it. You know, I I ride a Harley Davidson now, and you know, it's all about being sober and enjoying the country and the fresh air and our mountains and you know, I ride Sea-Doos now, and you know, just living a clean and sober life is the only way to go. There's just so much fun that I never knew was there. And now that I've had a chance to experience some of it, I can't believe that I ever used. But I know that, you know, this is just what, you know, this is how my life went, and I don't knock it. And I'm also, you know, a little bit grateful, you know, a grateful addict. And the reason being is because I've lived in hell. I've lived through hell. I've, you know, my drug use and drug life, I was a heroin addict for 5 years, and I was slamming cocaine for 10 years and crack cocaine, and I've lived through hell. That was just real hell, that whole period of my life. And because of that, I really know what life is now. You know, I have a clean and sober life now, and I can you know, I have the yin and yang of life here. You know, I've got I'm really appreciating the sobriety and compared to living in bondage to drugs every day in my whole life.
Well, Dean, thank you. We are out of time. Again, I appreciate you coming in. One more time, if anybody needs to get a hold of Dean, give them the website.
AlcoholDrugsAddiction.com.
Thank you. And for next week, please listen in. We're going to have Dr. Shelley Zavala. Thank you.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.